This article appeared in the winter 2008 issue of UU World magazine and is available online at uuworld.org. Forum: Women Crafting a Better World by Christine Nielsen. 15 years ago, Nelly Nacino was one of 60 women to receive a sewing machine through a livelihood program in Taguig, Philippines. The sewing machine was not a gift. Each woman was expected to pay for her machine on an installment plan. Nelly has done more than that. Her contributions have gone far beyond the program's initial investment in her. Nelly benefited from support that included a national training program, local government, local cooperative organizations, and Zonta International, a global organization working to advance the status of women worldwide. I was introduced to her story by Patricia Samia of the University of the Philippines. But it was Nelly's motivation to help other women and their families that transformed financial resources and equipment into a thriving business and a social enterprise organization she established, the Mother and Child Community Development Association, Incorporated, MCCDAI. Nelly's entrepreneurial activity began with the opening of a small store based on a capital investment of 100 Philippine pesos, roughly the equivalent of $2. Pregnant with her third child while her husband Antonio worked abroad, she began selling canned goods, household items, and products she had sewn. In 2000, Nelly's husband joined her. They hired 6 employees for store sales, order deliveries, and business administration. In addition to managing her internal workforce, Nelly now subcontracts rag-making production to 30 to 40 members of the MCCDAI. She encourages her neighbors in MCCDAI to become entrepreneurs themselves, explaining that they can earn more if they buy their own materials. MCCDAI adopted the same motto as Nelly's enterprise: We will help you help yourselves. This motto embodies the heart and soul of the global social enterprise movement. MCCDAI does far more than generate revenues for its workers. It offers seminars on birth control, family planning, and livelihood training, sewing, food service training, meat processing, baking, and soap making, among others. Furthermore, the organization enables qualified children of its members to obtain college scholarships. In 2007, 40 of their scholars completed college. The organization also provides free school supplies to about 50 children every year. Events that transform our lives often pass unnoticed at first. They occur within the flurry of our daily lives while we're focusing on other things. When Nelly received her first sewing machine, she never anticipated that it would start her on the path towards social enterprise development. I've had that same kind of experience twice. The first such event occurred when I was 8 years old and eventually led to my career as a professor of international business and strategy. I didn't realize its significance until many years later, during an interview with the Baltimore Business Journal, when the reporter asked, "What was it that led to your decision to enter this profession?" Scrolling back in my mind, I realized that the transforming event had been a childhood summer spent in Denmark. Embraced by my father's Danish family, fascinated with their lives and language, playing daily with Danish children, it was a real cross-cultural immersion for me. I realized it was that childhood experience that had led me to a lifetime of learning, teaching, and research to better understand the differences and similarities we share with people around the world, so that I could continue to experience, and hopefully help others to know, the joy, sense of adventure, and belonging that I had felt as a child when stepping outside of my own national boundaries. The second event that transformed my life occurred in 2004. It was a conversation with my friend Phyllis Marsh during choir practice at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Annapolis, UUCA, that led to my current work in the global social enterprise movement. The theme of the upcoming Sunday's sermon was world peace, and I whispered that we wouldn't have peace in this world until women had more rights. Unless women could develop economically, their children would continue to grow up in poverty, without education, and the cycle of desperation that drives wars and terrorism would continue without end. That declaration during choir practice would lead to a profound change in the focus of my professional life, intertwining its threads with those of my spiritual life as a Unitarian Universalist. I signed up to attend my first UUA General Assembly as a delegate in 2004, and again in 2005 to speak on behalf of the Women's Rights Worldwide Study Action Issue, proposed first by the Reverend Carol Houston and the Community Unitarian Church at White Plains, New York, and then in partnership with the UUCA. We studied issues affecting the lives of women and their families, analyzed their disadvantages in economic, political, and social spheres, and sought to understand the extent of their suffering through physical abuse, the slave trade, armed conflicts, and war zones. Our initiative was voted down 2 years in a row, but we refused to be defeated. Instead, we decided to take action. The UUCA UN Global Justice Committee reached out to the Reverend Rebecca Sienes, then president of the UU Church of the Philippines, UUCP. Together, we worked to develop a program in the Philippines as a model for women's development. Sienes and her team from the UUCP began by asking women in 12 poor, rural communities on Negros Island what they saw as their most important priorities. Phyllis and I, along with other members of our UN Global Justice Committee, traveled there to hear directly from hundreds of women. Their number one priority was clear: livelihood opportunities. They spoke emphatically of wanting to contribute economically to their family's welfare through their own efforts and to help their husbands support their children. We concluded our visit with a 3-day strategic planning meeting that forged an international partnership linking Philippine and U.S. Unitarian Universalist organizations with local communities on Negros Island. As a result of these efforts and grants from the UUCA Endowment Committee, the UU Women's Federation, and contributions of the UUCP, an organization was established for women's development in the Philippines called Buhata Pine, Do It, Filipina. Since that fateful conversation at choir practice, I've been on a steep learning curve, coming to understand the potential that social enterprise initiatives have to transform the lives of disadvantaged people worldwide. I am also learning about its transformative power in my own life and in those of others who are searching for ways to be of service in the face of the staggering social issues that face our world. Still a novice in this arena, I've become more deeply engaged in the field of social enterprise, seeking out stories of success and failure, building a research foundation on lessons learned, looking for ways to contribute to business skills training for micro-entrepreneurs, and traveling to the Philippines, most recently as a Fulbright Psi Kip Distinguished Lecturer in the fall of 2007. I am building relationships with professors and practitioners active in social enterprise development and exploring ways that we can collaborate. We are within a year of launching a joint livelihood pilot project that will expand the network of UU partners working on women's development in the Philippines. Along the way, I've learned that women, working together in spirit, faith, and partnership, can strengthen the global web of life. Starting small and forming partnerships with like-minded people who are committed to making a positive difference in people's lives is something that Nelly Nacino and I share. We've realized that great things can happen if you are willing to take the first step. A single event can start you on the path. How you can get involved. International Convocation of UU Women. UU Women and others of progressive faiths from across the United States and close to 20 countries will gather for the first International Convocation of UU Women in Houston, Texas, February 26th through March 1st, 2009. For more information, visit www.icuuw.com or call 877-424-5608. Women's Rights Worldwide, a project of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Annapolis, Maryland, United Nations Global Justice Committee, where you can learn more about the Buhata Pine, Do It Filipina program. Visit www.womensrightsworldwide.com. Christine Nielsen is a professor of international business and strategy at the University of Baltimore's Merrick School of Business. A member of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Annapolis's UN Global Justice Committee, she serves as co-chair of the Buhata Pine, Do It Filipina program, and is on the advisory committee for the 2009 International Convocation of Unitarian Universalist Women. Ted Sorensen, JFK's Unitarian speechwriter. An interview with President Kennedy's counselor and speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, by Jane Greer. In his new memoir, Ted Sorensen, President John F. Kennedy's closest advisor and major speechwriter, celebrates his Unitarian upbringing in 1930s Nebraska. Like the Good Samaritan of whom Jesus spoke, Sorensen writes in a chapter about his religious and political development as a young person, Unitarians have a love for the least, the last, and the lost, a belief in integrating faith with works. Sorensen, who was born in 1928 in Lincoln, Nebraska, was one of five children. His father, C.A. Sorensen, was a well-known progressive politician and lawyer who served 4 years as Nebraska's Attorney General. As a student at Grand Island Baptist College, C.A., a talented debater and orator, competed in the Nebraska State Oratory Contest with an address entitled The Dead Hand of the Past, in which he impugned the importance of religion. The speech won him first prize and expulsion from college. C.A.'s story made the news, and he was soon after contacted by Walter Locke, associate editor of the Nebraska State Journal, who told him that he needed to be at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and also that he needed to go to a Unitarian church. Locke helped with his university admission, and the Lincoln Unitarian minister arranged for a scholarship covering his tuition. So began the Sorensen family's relationship with Unitarianism. Unitarian values, Sorensen writes in Counselor, A Life at the Edge of History, Harper, 2008, $27.95, are reflected in many of the speeches he drafted for Kennedy. Sorensen worked with Kennedy from his start as a senator in 1953 through his assassination as president in November 1963. A graduate of the University of Nebraska Law School, Sorensen was only 25 when he started with Kennedy. However, even as a young man, he had already asserted himself as a civil rights activist, conscientious objector, and liberal. Religion was an especially important issue in the 1960 presidential race, when many Protestants viewed Kennedy's Catholicism as a detriment, fearing that the Pope and the Catholic hierarchy would unduly influence him. In probably his best-known speech on the subject, delivered to the Houston Ministerial Association on September 12, 1960, Kennedy asserted, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote." After his White House years, Sorensen worked as a private attorney in the field of international law. In 1966, he joined the firm Paul, Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison, where he specialized in representing clients on relations with foreign governments, a task that took him all over the world. As part of these assignments, he had the opportunity to meet with world leaders ranging from Nelson Mandela to Manuel Noriega. Sorensen suffered a stroke in 2001, which left him visually impaired. With time on his hands, he was finally able to turn to writing his memoir, which he did with the help of Adam Frankel, a Princeton University and London School of Economics graduate. The book took 6 years to complete. Sorensen spoke with UU World at his apartment overlooking Central Park in New York City in September 2008. His sister, Ruth Sorensen Singer, was visiting and offered an anecdote from her childhood, which is included in the interview. An abridged version appears in the winter issue of UU World. How did people feel about Roman Catholics in the 1950s and 60s? Clearly, there was a very large number that didn't think Catholics should be president of the U.S. There was an organization in which Unitarians, along with Southern Baptists, probably played an important role. It was called POAU, Protestants and Other Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, now known as Americans United for Separation of Church and State. I think that a Methodist bishop, Garfield Bromley Oxnam, may have been the president at that time, and I had a secret meeting with him to enlist his help with the campaign. To support Kennedy? To at least support a statement by a lot of leading Protestant clergymen saying that religion should not play a role in the selection of a president. They were not thereby committing themselves to campaign for Kennedy, but it's a little like when I mobilized the South Africa Free Elections Fund Foundation many years later. The reason it was a foundation and contributions were tax-deductible was because it was for voter education in South Africa. Mandela was smart enough to realize immediately that the whites didn't need voter education. They'd been voting all their lives. So a statement saying religion should not play any role in the selection of a president could only benefit one person. How did religion feature as a campaign issue? Clearly, whether we liked it or not, Kennedy's religion was a major issue. A group of leading Protestant clergymen had a conference at the Waldorf Astoria, which they called the Conference on Religious Freedom, which was to discuss the presidential election because they thought religious freedom was at stake if a Roman Catholic became president. In fact, the Reverend Norman Vincent Peale, author of The Power of Positive Thinking, did not have such positive thoughts about Kennedy and said something like, "I'm not saying that we should be opposed to his election. I'm just saying it would be a different country if he were elected." To which Kennedy said, "He could have been complimenting me." Richard Nixon, Kennedy's opponent, piously said, "I am not going to raise the religion issue." To demonstrate his sincerity, he said that in every state. So, of course, it was out there. We would see hate mail coming into the office. We would see people holding up anti-Catholic signs on the campaign trail along the routes of the motorcade. Finally, in what I have to assume was an annual meeting, the Houston Protestant ministers invited Kennedy and Nixon to come speak to them. Nixon shrewdly declined, saying he was busy. I remember the discussion, which Robert Kennedy, who was his brother's campaign manager, joined. We decided that we had no wish to avoid the issue. Bury it or ignore it, we needed to take this on. The president of the American Unitarian Association issued a statement on Kennedy's death on how much he had meant to freedom of religion and free speech in this country. That was an extraordinary thing for a Unitarian to say about a Catholic politician. Kennedy was clearly more than a Catholic politician. What are some of the Unitarian principles in Kennedy's speeches? My favorite of all Kennedy's speeches, and usually I try to minimize my role, but in this I did have a major role, was his commencement address at American University in 1963. In that speech, one of the lines is, "Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man." Sounds like good Unitarianism to me. In the inaugural address, he concludes saying, "With history, the final judge of our deeds." That's not what other churches would say. That's Unitarianism. Did your family go to church? My father had been a Unitarian ever since his change of fortune that I describe in the book. My mother was born and raised Jewish, even though For one reason or another, she was no longer an observant Jew. She went to church most of the time, probably not as regularly as my father. All five children went to church. After I was too old to go to Sunday school, I went to church. Did the minister talk about God? No. Was he more of a humanist? Very much so. Why do you not refer to yourself as a Unitarian Universalist? I grew up a Unitarian, and I still am a Unitarian. I'm sure Universalists are equally wonderful. Why are you not a current member of a church? Before I lost effective use of my eyes, every Sunday morning I would play tennis, and I justify this when people ask me by saying, "It's okay, because tennis goes back to the Bible." When they challenge that, I say, "Of course, there's a passage in the Bible. Joseph served in Pharaoh's court." I thought that it was one of the basic tenets of Unitarianism that the whole world is my church. Look at the view out this window. What church could possibly be as beautiful as that? Ruth Sorensen Singer. We didn't have church over the summer because it was a small church and the minister got time off. But when I was around 10 years old, someone asked me, "How come you don't go to church in the summer?" And I said, "The minister needs time off." And they asked, "Don't you need God during the summer?" And I said, "I guess we don't need God in the winter either." Did you ever have any problems as a Unitarian working with a Roman Catholic? No problem whatsoever. Fortunately, he did not go along with the Catholic hierarchy's position on church and state. He was opposed to federal funds for parochial schools. In those days, abortion was not a big issue. It was the days before Roe v. Wade. There was no big political debate about abortion. There was a modest debate about population control. And he was the first president of the U.S. to support U.N. funding for population control. It sounds like Kennedy had character. Yes, he did. And in many broader senses of the word, he was a humanist, because he looked to human beings to solve problems caused by human beings. Are you concerned about the weakening of the divide between church and state? I'm very worried about it, and I strongly disagree with it. It's so ironic that the religious right in those days opposed Kennedy because they said if a Catholic is elected president, then members of the clergy might influence public policy, and a priest or a clergyman might even tell his parishioners how to vote, which is all going on now, from the very same quarters that were attacking Kennedy from the religious right. You support Democratic presidential nominee Senator Barack Obama? Very much so. You have said that you see parallels between his being black and Kennedy's Catholicism. I certainly do. We'll find out if being black is even a bigger obstacle than being Catholic. It might be bigger. People don't admit to their prejudices and bigotry. Is eloquence still appreciated? I hope so. It's words that enable the president of the U.S. to galvanize support in the country, to mobilize support in the Congress, and to attract support from our allies and others around the world. Kennedy was respected and, indeed, revered in many countries of the world because you could tell from his words, his statements, his speeches, his positions, that he was a man with a good heart and compassion and wanted peace. Yes, I think words matter a great deal. Is it too late for a Kennedy to galvanize the country? I don't know why it should be. It requires remarkable leadership. Attitudes in this country are largely set at the top. Now we have a president who, with his cronies, has dumbed down governing and speeches. And it's not surprising that for some time the public has not had someone who could elevate their sights. That's what Kennedy did. He lifted up the sights of the American people. He didn't speak down to them. Another chap might do it again. I think Obama might just be that kind of president. Kennedy seemed to have a special appeal to youth.
Nobody that young had ever run for president before. He appealed to the young, in part because his ideas were fresh and new, offering change and hope. And Bobby Kennedy, likewise. I think it was the combination of those two deaths and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death that added to the disillusionment of young people, along with Nixon, Vietnam, and Watergate. They became cynical, and no candidate had any particular appeal to them. Obama is bringing them back in, and I think that's very important and healthy for the country. Most of the activism is going to come from young people.
What do you think of churches supplying more and more social services?
It's fine, as long as it's not with federal or other public taxpayers' funds, because it's impossible for those churches to do it in a way that does not proselytize for new members in their churches, and taxpayer funds should not be used for that purpose. In terms of churches opening shelters and kitchens for the poor and things like that, good. When I was a young man working for civil rights, I looked to churches for a lot of the help I got in those days when civil rights was not a popular issue.
Kennedy seemed to favor a strong role for the executive branch.
He was in favor of a president who leads. He recognized that presidents could make it a better world and a better country. He felt it was their obligation to do that. And if that encourages presidents who are less competent and more right-wing in their ideology to also be strong presidents and lead us in the wrong direction, citing Kennedy, then, yes, I do worry about that. I was worried when George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice invoked Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis when they favored a unilateral invasion of Iraq, which was the last thing in the world Kennedy would have done.
Was Kennedy against war?
He had served in the war and had seen his brother and two of his best friends killed in the war. Although he was elected in part because he was a war hero, he was very anti-war. He was the commander-in-chief of the greatest military force in the world, maybe in the history of the entire world. And as Bush and even Clinton discovered, it's so tempting to say, I've got all this military power, of course I'll use it. Kennedy never invaded anybody.
What advantages has Unitarianism given you?
Unitarians know how to be skeptical. They're skeptics by nature. Unitarians know how to ask questions, hard, tough questions, and that's very important in a complicated world in which we now live.
And yet in the book you describe yourself as an optimist.
I don't see any inconsistency between skepticism and optimism. You'll have a hard time knocking either one of them out of me.
What does freedom of religion mean to you?
Freedom of religion in this country is freedom to go to the church of your choice, but also to go to no church at all. I don't mind when children are asked to recite the Lord's Prayer at school. As my sister said, she could never keep it straight whether she was apologizing for her sins or her trespasses. Therefore, I don't mind that the U.S. Senate opens with a prayer and things of that sort. There are some people who think that separation of church and state means being anti-religious. I'm not anti-religious. If we're all going to get along in one country, even Unitarians have to be reasonable.
Jane Greer is senior editor at UU World. Book Review: Reason for Alarm by Ed Dorr. Two of Unitarian Universalism's core values, the affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person and the right of conscience, have led UUs repeatedly to endorse the separation of church and state and full reproductive choice. The General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association has adopted resolutions affirming church-state separation 6 times since 1961. GA has spoken out in favor of the right to an abortion 9 times. Our respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, meanwhile, has been expressed in almost 30 General Assembly resolutions about overpopulation, hunger, resource depletion, protecting the environment, and global warming. 3 new books help us place these Unitarian Universalist commitments in the context of the history of American religion and current discourse on the place of reason in politics and social action. In Head and Heart, A History of Christianity in America, Penguin Press, 2007, $17, historian Gary Wills details the intertwined histories of Enlightenment religion and American evangelicalism. He explores the Puritan evangelicalism of our colonial beginnings, which has ebbed and flowed from 1630 to its upsurge as the religio-political or theocon right of the Reverend Pat Robertson, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, James Dobson, and Charles Colson. The First Great Awakening did play a preparatory role for the Enlightenment, not as a precursor of it, but as a provocation. The Enlightenment was spurred by the reaction to the Awakening. Wills agrees with historian William Lee Miller that the chief founders of the nation were all deists. Miller lists Washington, Franklin, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, and Paine, though many more leaders of the founding era could be added, such as Rush, Witherspoon, Freneau, Burr, Morris, and Barlow. Will shows how Jefferson and Madison led in developing the principle of church-state separation, our country's unique contribution to political theory and practice, which is enshrined in the Constitution, the First Amendment, and most state constitutions, and was affirmed by the Supreme Court in 1879 and in a long series of rulings beginning in 1947. This is a story also well told by UU ministers Forrest Church and Gary Kowalski in recent books, So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State, Harcourt, 2007, and Revolutionary Spirits, The Enlightened Faith of America's Founding Fathers, Blue Bridge, 2008, and Frederick S. Lane in The Court and the Cross, The Religious Rights Crusade to Reshape the Supreme Court, Beacon, 2008. Wills devotes a dozen pages to the contributions of Unitarians, Universalists, and Socinians to the development of Enlightenment values, citing Locke, Priestley, Adams, Ware, the nominally Presbyterian Witherspoon, and Jefferson. After the American Revolution, however, it would soon become commonplace to charge that a Unitarian was no better than a deist no better than a Jacobin, and a Jacobin no better than an atheist. The 19th century saw the fading of deism, the rise of transcendentalism, the Second Great Awakening, which foundered on the reef of the Civil War, and the reemergence of evangelicalism during the Gilded Age, which in turn faltered after the 1925 Scopes trial and the failure of Prohibition. Political evangelicalism was reborn after the Vietnam War, when a culture war broke out over abortion rights, school prayer, feminism, gay rights, pornography, creationism, and control of the Supreme Court and government itself at all levels. Wills, a practicing Roman Catholic, takes on the leadership of his own church. He praises the reforms of Pope John XXIII and the Second Vatican Council, but adds that those reforms began to be eroded with Paul VI and his 1968 encyclical condemning contraception, though a strong majority of his own advisors had urged liberalization. Regarding abortion rights, he writes, "It is not demonstrable that killing fetuses is killing persons." Highlighting the inconsistencies in his church's official position, he observes that the Jewish and Christian scriptures and theologians never regarded early fetuses as persons. At the end of the day, abortion rights are a matter of turning to reason and science, the realism of enlightened religion. The relevant experts are philosophers, neurobiologists, embryologists, whose views evangelicals do not want to hear. Wills agrees with the consensus of scientists that a fetus does not become a human person until it has a functioning brain, which is not present in the fetus until the end of the sixth month at the earliest. Wills concludes with a section on the Karl Rove era and the faith-based government of George W. Bush. Rove's real skill lay in finding how to use religion as a political tool, making the executive branch more openly and avowedly religious than it had ever been. Ironically, he notes, Rove has no discernible religious beliefs himself. Church-state separation, Wills sums up, is what the founders intended, and contrary to the theocons' rants, it has not led to the suppression of religion by the state. Just the opposite. It meant the freeing of religion. We can see in the past how a breaching of the separation led to setbacks for religion. The Karl Rove era, Wills argues, has again discredited religion as a political tool. Wills also argues that enlightened religion need not be desiccated and cerebral, while evangelical religion need not be mindlessly enthusiastic, all heat and no light. To paraphrase Khalil Gibran, let passion fill your sails, but let reason be your rudder. Willis confirms what you use generally already know. His book's importance lies in its clear refutation of the Christian nation idea that many theological conservatives and would-be theocrats have been pushing for well over a century. In The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, Island Press, 2008, $35, biologists Paul and Anne Ehrlich contend, one species, Homo sapiens, has become so powerful that it can significantly undermine the ability of Earth's environment to support much of life, including our own. Human technology and the population explosion it has made possible endanger the planet, but the authors make the case that only careful use of scientific rationality can help us avoid disaster. They show, perhaps even better than Al Gore's film book, An Inconvenient Truth, that the most serious threats now faced by humanity are slow, deleterious changes in the environmental background itself, changes our perceptual systems have evolved to encourage us to ignore. The only way to recognize the change is by interpreting graphs made by scientific instruments that were designed to extend our perceptual systems. Human population growth, they make clear, has been so prodigious in recent centuries that it has also become a major driver of environmental deterioration in the extent of pollution, consumption of nature's resources, and destruction of habitats needed by other species, which they later explain are important for our own survival. On top of other effects, population size is also the elephant in the living room on the issue of global heating. For if the size of the human population were only half what it is today, the chances of avoiding a climate catastrophe would be much better. With a population-environment crisis facing us, but about which most people are ignorant, we must be grateful to the Ehrlichs for detailing the complex and intertwined issues facing our planet. Among the facts they lay before us, agricultural lands and groundwater are being used up faster than they can be replenished. Humanity is running a vast chemical experiment in which all of us are the lab rats, and the results are still in doubt. In terms of environmental damage, meat is much more costly to produce than our staple food crops such as rice, wheat, maize, and potatoes, while grazing is a major cause of deforestation and farm-based pollution. The world has lost nearly half of its post-ice age forest cover, most of it since 1970. human density increases vulnerability to epidemic disease. In 2002, when the population had passed 6 billion, civilization's demand on the biosphere had reached more than 120 or 140% of its regenerative capacity. And finally, we may well have already exceeded the long-term carrying capacity of our planet by as much as 40%. At the heart of our planetary problem is unchecked human population growth. Appropriately, they cite the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech on accepting a Planned Parenthood Award in 1966. There is no human circumstance more tragic than the persisting existence of a harmful condition for which a remedy is readily available. Family planning to relate population to world resources is possible, practical, and necessary. Unlike plagues of the Dark Ages or contemporary diseases we do not yet understand, the modern plague of overpopulation is soluble by means we have discovered and with resources we possess. Curiously, the authors make no mention of the National Security Study Memorandum 200, NSSM 200, report approved by President Ford in 1975 but classified and suppressed until nearly the eve of the 1994 UN Population Conference. NSSM 200 spelled out the worldwide consequences of unchecked population growth and recommended universal access to family planning information, education, and wherewithal. Oddly, the authors also do not discuss the role of religious fundamentalisms in holding back overpopulation remedies. Remedies recommended by the Ehrlichs include checking population growth, ending overconsumption and waste, reducing the influence of money in politics from eco-unfriendly industries, expanding eco-friendly political activity, reducing income inequalities that fuel environmental deterioration, and greatly reducing dependence on fossil fuels. They conclude, "Will future hunters and gatherers wonder over the origins of skyscrapers, railroads, and freeways, and invent religions to explain them? Or will future intergalactic visitors think it impossible that the depauperate tribal people they encounter are actually descendants of the builders?" The Age of American Unreason by Susan Jacoby, Pantheon Books, 2008, $26, is both important and guaranteed to give readers a headache. She writes that the scales of American history have shifted heavily against the vibrant and varied intellectual life so essential to functional democracy. America's endemic anti-intellectual tendencies have been grievously exacerbated by a new species of semi-conscious anti-rationalism, feeding on and fed by an ignorant popular culture of video images and unremitting noise that leaves no room for contemplation or logic. She blames dumbed-down mass media, the shrinking of newspapers, the decline of serious book reading, the resurgence of fundamentalist religion. Willed ignorance is one of the defining characteristics of fundamentalism, as is the nexus between fundamentalism and lack of education and the scientific illiteracy of much of the media. She scores junk science and junk thought, as in the Supreme Court's 2007 ruling upholding a ban on partial birth abortion based on a wholly junk science concept, post-abortion syndrome, invented by anti-choice organizations. Jacoby hails the United States' intentionally secular constitution and church-state separation, noting, ironically, that separation helped pave the way for the spread of fundamentalism, while European church-state unions tended to stimulate free-thinking and Enlightenment values. She hits the culture of distraction produced by the proliferating visual images and noises of the video digital age that permeate the minute-by-minute experience of our lives, a continuous invasion of individual thought and consciousness. The more time people spend before the computer screen or any screen, the less time and desire they have for two human activities critical to a fruitful and demanding intellectual life, reading and conversation. And the more obsessed people are with infotainment, the less likely they are to read anything. Jacoby turns to George W. Bush. The son, grandson, and great-grandson of rich and powerful men, George W. Bush is a walking testament to unearned privilege who somehow managed to convince voters that he was just an ordinary guy and did not belong to the detested elites. The issue is not whether Bush is as stupid as he sounds, but that he is unashamed of, and even seems quite proud of, his own parochialism and intellectual limitations. She cites the one-sidedness of intellectual participation in his administration, exemplified by his Council on Bioethics. The real purpose of the Bioethics Advisory Group was not to advise, but to provide academic cover for the administration's religiously and politically motivated politics. Jacoby is very much on target, unfortunately, and her thesis would have been even more depressing if she had devoted attention to the tsunami of ultra-conservative propaganda and Orwellian hate speech gushing from far too many popular radio and television talk shows. This new age of American unreason threatens the secular democracy whose development Wills traces so well and makes it more difficult for us dominant animals to deal with the threats spelled out by the Ehrlichs. We do have our work cut out for us. Ed Dorr wrote the 1982 UUA General Assembly Resolution on Church-State Separation. The former president of the American Humanist Association, Dorr has been the CEO of Americans for Religious Liberty since 1982. He is the author of My Life as a Humanist and many other books. A UU for almost 60 years, Dorr is a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Rockville, Maryland. Books by UU authors, by Jane Greer and Sonia L. Cohen. Fiction. The Great Circus Train Robbery, a Northern Spy Mystery. Nancy Means Right. Hilliard and Harris, 2008, 1695. This middle-grade novel, based on the spying adventures of Wright's own children, is a sequel to The Pea Soup Poisonings, which won the 2006 Agatha Award for Best Children's YA Novel. Wright is a member of the Champlain Valley Unitarian Universalist Society in Middlebury, Vermont. The Stylist, a novel by Kai Emmons. Harper Perennial, 2007, 1395. Hayden, a 25-year-old Harvard dropout working in a Hoboken hair salon, and Emery, a 40-year-old woman transitioning to become a man, go to a Costa Rican eco-resort to rescue Hayden's injured father. The journey both heals and changes them. Playwright and novelist Kai Emmons teaches at the University of Oregon and is a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Eugene, Oregon. Nonfiction. Love and Death, My Journey Through the Valley of the Shadow. Forest Church. Beacon Press, 2008, $22. The Reverend Dr. Forest Church, preeminent UU theologian and longtime minister of the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City, writes a memoir of his experiences with the deaths of family members and friends, and a meditation on his own impending death from cancer. After-School Theater Programs for At-Risk Teenagers, Philip Zwirling, McFarland, 2008, $35. The Reverend Dr. Philip Zwirling, a UU minister and assistant professor of English at the University of Texas Pan American in Edinburgh, Texas, looks at how youth theater programs can make a positive impact on teens, includes a list of more than 100 current programs. Black History in the Pages of Children's Literature, Rose Casement, Scarecrow Press, 2007, $55. This educational resource provides an introduction to historical periods and an annotated bibliography of children's literature that would be useful for teaching topics in Black history to a youthful audience. Case Mont is Associate Dean of Education at the University of Michigan, Flint, and is a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Flint. The Light Within, the extraordinary friendship of a doctor and patient brought together by cancer. Lois M. Raymondetta and Deborah Rose Sills, William Morrow, 2008, 2495. A dual memoir of an oncologist, Raymondetta, and a patient, Sills, who was a professor of religion. Although a memoir, the book talks about the diagnosis, treatment, side effects, and anxieties of ovarian cancer. Sills passed away in 2006. Raymondetta, an associate professor at the University of Texas, MD, Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, is a member of the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Houston, Texas. Buffalo Gal, a memoir. Laura Peterson, Fulcrum, 2008, $15. This humorous memoir recounts the author's life, from her wild childhood in Buffalo, New York, to her high-power Wall Street career as the youngest person with a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. The author of 8 books, Peterson has written for the New York Times and is a member of the UU Church of Amherst, New York, and the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City. Environment, an interdisciplinary anthology. Selected, edited, and with introductions by Glenn Adelson, James Engel, Brent Rinaldi, and K.P. Van Anglen. Yale University Press, 2007. $70. This major anthology is the first to apply a fully interdisciplinary approach to environmental studies. The book demonstrates how the sciences, social sciences, and humanities all contribute to understanding our interrelationships with the natural world. Brent Rinaldi, a member of Fallen Church Society in Lexington, Massachusetts, is a senior analyst at the Cadmus Group, an employee-owned environmental consulting firm. The Informed Gardener, Linda Chalker Scott, University of Washington Press, 2008, 1895. An Introduction to Sustainable Landscaping Practice. Chalker Scott addresses some of the myths and problems that plague both home and professional gardeners, such as, are native plants the best choice for sustainable landscaping? An extension urban horticulturalist and associate professor at Washington State University and author of an online column, Horticultural Myths, Chalker Scott is also a member of University Unitarian Church in Seattle, Washington. Hiking Out, Surviving Depression with Humor and Insight Along the Way, Dick Sederquist, Publishing Works, 2007, 1595. A collection of essays and stories about life through the eyes of a hiker. Sederquist, a member of the Universalist Church of West Hartford, Connecticut, is a cancer survivor and also overcame a lifelong battle with depression. The book was a Best Books Award finalist at USA Book News. Ministry Among God's Queer Folk, David J. Kuntz and Bernard S. Schlager, The Pilgrim Press, 2007, $25. A practical handbook that covers basic skills religious caregivers and ministry students need in order to be supportive and enlightened care providers to LGBTQ persons. Fourth book in the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies in Religion and Ministry series, sponsored by Pilgrim Press and the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies in Religion and Ministry at Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, California. Bernard S. Schlager, Director of National Programming at the Center and an adjunct professor there, is a member of the Champlain Valley Unitarian Universalist Society in Middlebury, Vermont. The New Writer's Handbook, 2007, and The New Writer's Handbook, Volume 2, edited by Philip Martin, Scarletta Press, 2007 and 2008, 1695. This annual anthology of articles by notable authors, journalists, writing instructors, editors, agents, and literary bloggers offers writers advice on their craft and careers, including how-to pieces and topics on professional issues and the creative process. Martin, an author, editor, and literary consultant who directs Great Lakes Literary, was acquisitions editor of the writer's book. He is a member of the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Ted Kooser, who writes the preface for Volume 2, is a former U.S. Poet Laureate and a member of the Unitarian Church of Lincoln, Nebraska. Spiritual Transformations, Science, Religion, and Human Becoming. Carl E. Peters, Augsburg Fortress, 2008, $7. Examines, through story and analysis, the many varieties of spiritual transformation, both predictable and unexpected, and how these changes can bring about wholeness and a new sense of being. Peters is professor of philosophy and religion at Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida, and adjunct professor of philosophy at the University of Hartford, Connecticut. He is co-editor of Zygon, Journal of Religion and Science, and is a member of the University Unitarian Universalist Society in Orlando, Florida. To serve the president, continuity and innovation in the White House staff. Bradley H. Patterson, Brookings Institution Press, 2008, 3495. Gives an inside view of the White House staff, from policy offices to the grounds of Camp David. Patterson is a past president of the American Society for Public Administration who has lived and worked in Washington, D.C. for more than six decades, including 14 years on the White House staffs of Eisenhower, Nixon, and Ford. He is a member of River Road Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Bethesda, Maryland, and a former member of the UUA Board of Trustees. Thinking about retirement? Think again. Goal Exploration and Employment Strategies for Midlife and Beyond. Barbara B. Hildner. Frederick Fell, 2006, 1095. A practical guide for midlife and older adults evaluating their life options. The author, a career counselor, is a member of All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Jane Greer is UU World's senior editor. Sonia L. Cohen is the magazine's assistant editor. Submissions for books by UU authors may be sent to UU World, 25 Beacon Street, Boston, Massachusetts, 02108. Indicate publisher, date, price, and the author's UU affiliation. We cannot include every title and cannot return books. Preference will be given to books of general interest. Self-published books will be included selectively. Looking Back, Adlai Stevenson, The Original Egghead, by Kimberly French. Although five United States presidents have identified as Unitarians, the two Adamses, Jefferson, Fillmore, and Taft, it has been more than 50 years since a Unitarian was the nominee of a major political party. The last was Democrat Adlai Stevenson, who lost to Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1952 and 1956. Stevenson loved language and was a gifted orator. A sharp wit, he could be both high-minded and self-deprecating. In one oft-quoted story, a supporter shouted, "Governor Stevenson, you have the vote of all the thinking people," to which he replied, "That's not enough, madam. I need a majority." New York Herald Tribune columnist Stuart Alsop coined the term egghead to describe the urbane, intellectual, and balding Stevenson. The talent among his speechwriters was breathtaking. Archibald MacLeish, John Kenneth Galbraith, John Hersey, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Even so, he personally reworked every speech, often penciling in hundreds of changes, keeping crowds waiting, even letting them disperse, until he felt prepared. His advisors joked he'd rather write than be president, according to biographer Gene Baker. His political opponents in 1952 were vicious. Vice presidential nominee Richard Nixon, red-baiting Senator Joseph McCarthy, and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover smeared the Stevenson campaign as a bunch of pinks and pansies. In response, Stevenson quipped, "I would make a proposition to my Republican friends that if they will stop telling lies about the Democrats, we will stop telling the truth about them." Stevenson enjoyed enormous popularity internationally and among the growing college-educated American middle class. Celebrities Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, and Eleanor Roosevelt campaigned for him. Supporters adored him, not just for his style, but also for putting policy debate at the center of his campaign and for standing up to McCarthyism. His New America campaign foresaw programs Kennedy and Johnson were able to implement, and his calls for an end to nuclear testing became the Test Ban Treaty of 1963. Ever the cold warrior, he criticized the Eisenhower administration for losing half of Vietnam, and he favored a go-slow approach to civil and women's rights, infuriating younger activists. Between election cycles, Stevenson traveled widely overseas. He had hoped to become Secretary of State in the next Democratic administration, but John F. Kennedy tapped him as United Nations ambassador, a position that suited his international experience and oratory skills. At a high point of his career, in 1962, Stevenson famously demanded that the Soviet representative to the United Nations say whether his country was installing missiles in Cuba. "Don't wait for the translation. Answer yes or no." When the Soviet ambassador waffled, Stevenson produced photographs proving their existence. Stevenson grew up Unitarian. His mother was a Republican Unitarian, his father a Democratic Presbyterian. "I wound up in his party and her church, which seemed an expedient solution to the problem," he liked to say. When the Unitarian Universalist Association was formed in 1961, Stevenson wrote to the Reverend Dana McLean Greeley, its first president, "Congratulations on your election as president. I know from hearsay how satisfying that can be." After his son survived a serious auto accident in 1955, Stevenson joined the Presbyterian Church in Lake Forest, Illinois, near his home. When some Unitarians accused him of using religion for political ends, Stevenson explained that he had often attended the church of his father when he had lived in towns with no Unitarian church, but he always felt loyal to his church back in Bloomington, Illinois. Ministers of both denominations wrote him, assuring him dual affiliation was no problem. Stevenson died of a heart attack in London in 1965. President Lyndon Johnson, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, and author John Steinbeck attended his memorial service at the Unitarian Church in Bloomington. Greeley delivered the eulogy, calling Stevenson a universal citizen. Kimberly French is a UU World contributing editor and a member of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Middleborough, Massachusetts. Her work has appeared in Ticken, Utney Reader, Salon, and many other magazines. She is the author of Perkins School for the Blind. UU World is the magazine of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. This recording is made possible by the UUA Department of Communications and the UUA Accessibilities Office. I'm Dick Hill.